It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Madison stands out as a top performer in the upper Midwest for addressing the housing shortage over the past two decades.
A recent report by Storage Cafe, that's an online storage space marketplace, analyzed hundreds of cities, looking at their growth and in some cases their declines in different types of housing.
Madison's 37% growth in housing inventory during the years from 2005 to 2023 ranks the capital city 74th in the nationwide study. But some Texas cities far outpace the rest of the country when it comes to housing construction.
To talk about the findings, we turn to Kurt Paulson now, professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. He was not involved in the study. Kurt, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
So when you see Madison housing inventory ranking 74th out of 489 cities, what do you see as driving this trend in Madison?
Well, we have to think about both the supply side and the demand side. So in Madison and Dane County more broadly, demand has been driven by just phenomenal job growth over the last two decades, right? Madison is well regarded as a tech hub, a place where young people come. We have the university. We have a high quality of life. A lot of people want to move here. A lot of it is driven by companies like Epic that employ thousands of people. So there's just tremendous demand to live in Madison. And on the supply side, Madison and Dane County more broadly has responded to this demand by permitting and building thousands and thousands of units over time. And so, you know, through a number of administrations, the leaders in Madison and in Dane County have recognized we have a huge housing demand, a housing crisis. We need to do everything possible to permit more housing to be built and a greater variety of housing to be built.
This is a longer-term trajectory to get enough housing for the needs of the area. Is that what I'm hearing? It's not something that communities can do in just a few years, for instance.
Right. Building housing is a long-term play. Whether it's on the public sector side, changing zoning and planning regulations to allow more development, or on the development side, you know, once a developer looks at building some housing in an area, it's probably 3 to 4 years before that housing is really occupied. So, you know, and what we see in the data is the long-term trend of communities, whether they are responsive to the housing growth and job growth in their area, or whether they are not. And compared to other cities in Wisconsin, of course, Dane County is growing faster and Madison is growing faster, but some of our other cities are also growing due to job growth.
So the report shows Madison with a total inventory of more than 138,000 housing units in 2023. Which housing types does this report explore?
So one of the things the report points out, and everyone who drives around can see this, is that we have a lot of single-family detached home, a typical kind of ownership product, and then we have a number of large new apartment buildings,
yes. 50
or more units. And so what the report points out is just the shortage, really nationwide, but we see this everywhere, of the kind of middle-range housing. So we're talking, again, the duplex or the townhouse or the condo or kind of that really small multifamily 4 or 8 units that's embedded within a neighborhood.
Why is middle housing lagging behind? Why is this construction not keeping up?
The main issue is that zoning in most communities does not allow it, right? We have systematically changed our city policies across the country to really only allow the kind of large lot, single family detached. And that's where Madison really has made tremendous progress in the last 10 years through reforming zoning ordinances to allow more housing and a greater variety of housing. If you look at the report, most of this middle housing, the kind of row house or, you know, the Chicago duplex, is really in the older cities in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, and then in Chicago. We used to build cities where you would have a range of housing types, not just the single-family detached unit, in our neighborhoods. And so the main explanation is that zoning rules have systematically changed over the last 70 years.
Turning to other parts of the state, in this analysis, Milwaukee, Racine, and Green Bay all ranked over 420th, so really near the bottom of the report. Why might these cities be facing stagnant housing inventory over the two decades that this report focused on?
Well, we would want to think about a somewhat different explanation in each of the regions. So one of the unique things about this study is it looks at the city rather than at the county.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these cities like Green Bay and Milwaukee are landlocked. So there is still some housing growth in the surrounding suburbs and counties. But the truth is that job growth in these communities, while it has been positive, has been a lot slower. And the case of Milwaukee is unique because there you've seen overall population loss over the last 20 years, and that just reduces the need to build new housing. Although, of course, anyone who drives around Milwaukee sees that there's a lot of new construction going on right now.
Yeah. We are talking about a new housing inventory analysis showing Madison leading the upper Midwest during a nearly 20-year time frame. And we have UW-Madison Urban Planning Professor Kurt Paulson with us to break this down. Kurt, undeniably, the South, states like Texas, really showing a lot of growth in housing. What is happening in Texas?
Well, like everything, it's multiple factors together. But primarily in Texas, zoning rules, building codes, environmental standards are much weaker, much lower, and it's just a lot easier to build. And so we like to say places that are expensive don't build a lot of housing, but places that build a lot of housing are not expensive. So Texas makes it really easy to build a lot of housing. The other reason is that there's just a lot of migration patterns to the south and to the west. And it's January as we're recording this, and you look outside how cold it is in Wisconsin. There was a study a few years ago that showed that for county population growth rates, average January temperature was the most important predictor.
Wow. Huh. I think what is quite sobering to me about this report, it shows that housing inventories, they've increased in 91% of the cities that they analyzed here, but this growth hasn't brought down housing prices. What is going on there?
So they only look at the numbers in terms of the number of units produced.
Yeah.
But what they miss is all the people who are coming in addition to those housing units. So my own study for Dane County showed that we actually underproduced about 1,000 units per year during this time period. So we are building lots and lots of housing, but we are adding jobs and households faster than we can build housing units. So even though we're building a lot, we're not catching up. In order to bring down the price of housing, first of all, you would need construction costs to go way down. But unfortunately, they've gone up a lot in the last 5 years. And second, you would need to build enough housing so that you could have a sustained vacancy rate of 2% for single family and 5% for multifamily to bring down rents and housing prices. So again, the story is, imagine your friend is 2 miles ahead of you on the road and is driving 70 and you're driving 60 miles an hour and you want to catch up and you accelerate to 68, you're going faster, but you're still falling behind. And that's really where we are. We have such a hole that we've dug ourselves of not building enough housing after the Great Recession that we're playing catch up.
So this tight supply, this hole that we're in, so to speak, what do you see in your crystal ball in the future for housing construction of all different types for Wisconsin?
Right. So we've seen the legislature and the local leaders really react to this housing crisis with all hands on deck, with changes to zoning, with some over $500 million of funding. And so as we watch those play out, we all are starting to see in communities that people are recognizing we need to allow more housing and a greater variety of housing. But of course, we have some headwinds, and those headwinds are interest rates, construction costs, and then the wild card is, what immigration enforcement will do to the labor supply in construction. So a lot of people are predicting that housing construction in 2025 will be slower than in 2022 and 2023. And a lot of people are kind of waiting patiently to see what happens, particularly with interest rates.
One thing you didn't mention there, and I'm curious about, communities being welcoming to multifamily housing, being open to having apartment
yes.
buildings in their neighborhoods. What do you see happening there with that issue?
So it's definitely a mixed bag, and it goes community by community and neighborhood by neighborhood. And we've all seen videos and read stories about when the neighbors and the NIMBYs show up to say, no, we don't want this housing. But we're seeing a lot of communities really take leadership to say, listen, we are creating all these jobs, and if we want a vibrant economy, then you have to start thinking about the person who serves you coffee or takes care of your children, the teachers, the nurses, the police officers who serve your community. If they can't afford to live in your community, eventually you're just not going to have those services. So communities are starting to have this conversation that says, if we are creating all these jobs, we need to take the housing that goes along with it. And that means multifamily. So statewide, our multifamily production numbers have recovered relative to the crisis or the crash in 2008. Where we have not recovered is actually on the single family side.
Kurt, thank you for the analysis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. We've been talking about this new report that used Census Bureau data to analyze housing inventory changes across hundreds of cities between 2005 and 2023, with Madison being a leader in overall inventory growth in the Upper Midwest during this period of time.
Coming up, tariffs and trade retaliation could come back in a new Trump administration. Find out what that could mean for Wisconsin's economy with a close look at soybean farming.
We export almost 60% of our soybeans to China alone, and I would say 75% of all of the soybeans in my area are being exported. So to say we are dependent on it is a bit of an understatement.
That's next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 4 years ago, a mob of President Donald Trump's supporters battled with police while smashing and pushing their way into the U.S. Capitol.
More than 1,500 people have been charged with federal crimes for their actions on January 6, 2021. On his first day back in office, Trump pardoned nearly all the cases of the people charged with crimes in the U.S. Capitol riot, including people convicted of assaulting police officers.
WPR's Rich Kramer joined Morning Edition host Alex Crow yesterday before those pardons were issued to talk about the 11 defendants from Wisconsin.
11 defendants are from Wisconsin. What exactly are they accused of doing during those January 6th riots?
Well, charges vary. The most serious cases involve two individuals, Riley Casper of Saxon and Joseph Catani of Colgate. Casper pled guilty to assaulting officers and was sentenced to 37 months incarceration. The FBI's complaint includes screenshots of videos that show Casper spraying pepper spray at officers during a battle near the Capitol steps. Catani has also been charged with assaulting officers, along with violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. The FBI's complaint against him includes videos showing him pulling on a face shield worn by a Capitol police officer. Catani pleaded not guilty to all of the charges against him, and that case is still ongoing. A jury trial is set for July 7th. But many of the Wisconsin defendants have received a lesser charge of parading, demonstrating, or picketing inside a Capitol building. Those who have pleaded guilty to that charge have essentially received probation, community service, those sorts of things. And also, they've been ordered to pay some restitution.
Have any of these defendants from Wisconsin spoken publicly about their actions?
In Wisconsin, I only know of one person that has spoken out, and that's Michael Fitzgerald of Janesville. He's been charged with violent entry, disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds, obstructing an official proceeding, and others related to being inside the Capitol when he wasn't supposed to be. I was able to connect with Fitzgerald, and he initially agreed to do an interview, but later said he couldn't because of health issues. He's currently being treated for stage 4 cancer. But Fitzgerald has done interviews with conservative media outlets. In December, he told conservative WISN radio host Vicki McKenna that he was struck by some type of less lethal projectile in a battle with police near the stage being built for President Joe Biden's inauguration.
I felt like they were shooting tear gas rounds and munitions at us and behind us to kind of corral us like cattle up the staircases where the inaugural stage was being built.
So I went through and I watched video surveillance footage that showed Fitzgerald toward the front of a group of rioters who pushed past a line of police and a podium that they had put in a doorway to keep them out. This was on the Senate side of the Capitol. Fitzgerald told McKenna that he was pushed into the building by the crowd, but also that he knew he wasn't supposed to be in there.
Have any of Wisconsin's January 6th defendants, we said there were 11 of them, have any of them been charged with other crimes since then?
Yes, there are two pretty notable examples. One is Paul Kovacic of Milwaukee. He was charged with violent entry and other infractions for being in the Capitol on January 6th. He pleaded guilty to a charge of parading, picketing, and demonstrating in the Capitol and was sentenced to 90 days incarceration. But he never showed up to prison. Instead, he fled to Ireland in hopes of claiming asylum for fear of political persecution in the U.S. Ultimately, he was sentenced to 1 year in prison and 24 months probation. The other example is Kevin Loftus, who was living in Eau Claire when he drove to Washington for the January 6th rally. He was charged with violent entry and other charges, pleaded guilty to the parading charge, and was sentenced to 3 years probation and some community service. But last month, he was stopped trying to fly to Russia. He told the FBI he was trying to join up with the Russian army in its war against Ukraine.
We know that President Trump is now in office and he's made some comments. He's vowed to pardon those January 6th rioters, but he hasn't really been specific about those details. Do we have any idea about what that could look like?
Yeah, that is hard to say. So in March, Trump said that he's inclined to pardon many of the defendants, but he also said, quote, "I can't say for every single one," end quote. The more complex issue is what to do with those charged or convicted of felony charges like assaulting police officers. Trump hasn't given specifics about those cases, but recently Vice President J.D. Vance said January 6th defendants who committed violence should not be pardoned.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR reporter following politics in the state Supreme Court. He spoke with Morning Edition host Alex Crow yesterday. And updates since that conversation, after Trump's first day back in the White House, he did grant clemency to roughly 1,500 defendants who had been convicted of crimes based on their activities on January 6th, 2021.
This is Wisconsin Today.
With President Trump's inauguration yesterday, we're looking at one of his key campaign pledges. During the campaign, President Trump called tariffs the most beautiful word in the dictionary.
The tariffs he enacted during his first term caused disruptions for some businesses in America when other countries retaliated with tariffs of their own. Among those who felt the sting of tariffs were soybean farmers. Soybean exports to China fell by about 25% in 2017, Trump's first year in office.
Now we look at what lessons we learned from the trade war during Trump's first administration and what it all means in Wisconsin. Tanner Johnson is a first-generation farmer from Prairie Farm in Barron County in northwest Wisconsin. He's a member of the board of the American Soybean Association. And Thomas Kemp is chair and professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks.
And Tanner, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
Tanner, I want to start by talking about the soy industry here, big deal in Wisconsin. How much does the soy field count on exports?
We export almost 60% of our soybeans to China alone, and I would say 75% of all the soybeans in my area are being exported. So to say we are dependent on it is a bit of an understatement.
The first trade war under the first Trump administration, how big an impact did it have? It looks like it was significant, but I don't want to oversell it. What do you hear from your colleagues?
I believe the figure that economists have learned is it was $27 billion from the 2018 trade war, and soybeans are the number one ag export. So we took the brunt loss out of that, and it certainly was not a fun time back in those days.
Tom, as an economist, not just with soy, what do you see as some of the impacts when the U.S. starts putting in tariffs and then trading partners start reacting with tariffs against American products in agriculture in particular? What kind of things do you watch for?
In terms of agriculture, in terms of Wisconsin, you know, certainly the last round of trade wars reduced both imports and exports, reduced total value and volume of trade with China. And of course, that impacts a variety of industries. We've heard soybeans, quite a few others as well.
Are there cases where, hey, maybe agricultural sectors are benefiting from tariffs, from blocking maybe cheaper imports coming in, and so they're making more money, Tom?
Well, that's difficult to say on an individual firm level. Mm-hmm. It's likely. What we really see with the tariffs of the last big round of tariffs is a realignment of trade patterns. So, for example, prior to that, you know, we had a lot of trade with China, both inbound and outbound, and we see a lot of that get realigned to other areas, most notably Mexico. So, for example, trade with China drops off, but trade with Mexico picks up. So, goods and services are just moving in different directions around the globe.
Tanner, with the new Trump administration, the incoming president has said tariffs will be a big focus. What kind of things are you working toward lobbying for in the soy industry?
We're certainly monitoring the tariff situation very closely. I think the net negative that could come from some of the speculative, and right, let's remind ourselves that this is all speculation,
right,
until action is taken, but I think we could be losing up to $1 per bushel just in the value of soybeans if some of the tariffs at the 60% level are reinstated or enacted. And then that's just off of some of our economist studies, and ASA and the National Corn Growers kind of collaborated on some of those studies, and I'm very thankful to have them, but certainly something we're monitoring. And I'm trying not to be an alarmist. I think being an optimist is why we continue to farm every day, but trying not to be an alarmist.
And Tanner, in President Trump's first term in office, he offset his tariffs with subsidies to farmers. The idea being, okay, we understand that farmers are taking a hit here from this back and forth on trade. We're going to at least make them at least partly whole from what they're losing. Is that something that you saw as a benefit and that you'd want to see if we end up in a similar position this time around?
Any farmer in this country will tell you they want trade, not aid. We would love to receive $0 from the government because that's the sign of a healthy ag economy. So my message resounding will be, I would love a situation where we receive $0 from the government. And I just want to be able to, I want to exercise the opportunities we have in the global market. Farmers themselves are working very, very hard to continue to grow those. And the ones we have today, a lot of those came from farmers jumping on the airplanes and traveling internationally and developing those relationships.
And Tanner, do you see if we lose, say, China as a market, are there other markets that can pick up the slack when it comes to soy?
Realistically, there is no losing China. I would be very surprised if we were ever out of China as a trade partner. But they import, I think it's 58% of our soybeans as of 2024. And the next biggest markets are the EU and Mexico. And I want to say that's around 4% and 5% respectively. So there's no replacing China. And yes, there are other large countries such as India, but they are not importing soybeans, I mean, nearly to the degree of China. So it is very, very important that we maintain a good relationship in terms of trade for what we are doing in the soybean world anyways.
And Tom, I want to broaden things past agriculture now. What are some of the other sectors in Wisconsin that you watch for when it comes to the impact of tariffs from the U.S. and retaliation from other countries?
It's difficult to say at this point because we're not sure what industries will have tariffs levied upon them, and we couldn't say which reprisal tariffs will be levied upon us. I think it's important to understand first what a tariff is, and that's it's a tax on imported goods and services. And then once we understand it's a tax, it's like any other tax. The degree to which you can avoid it, you don't end up paying it. So, for example, if firms are able to adjust supply chains away from places like China that are likely to have tariffs levied upon them, then those impacts will be minimal. Firms that are not able to move away from China will see those impacts being greater. So the answer to the question would be to consider which industries, there's no substitutes for them. They need to trade with China. It, from what I'm hearing, it sounds like that the soybean market may be one of those. I'm sure there are others, but similarly, there'll be many industries that will shift to alternative markets.
And Tom, making things more complicated is the same tariff might affect two different businesses differently. For example, if we have a tariff on imported steel, that raises the price of steel. If I manufacture that kind of steel, I might win. If I manufacture goods using steel, well, my costs just went up potentially. Are tariffs a double-edged sword in a lot of sectors?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And the question in either of those cases is how can those costs be passed on or not? You know, if I can pass on higher costs downstream, then I can get somebody else to pay that. If I can't, then I'm going to be stuck with it. And that, again, is a question of substitutes. How easily can people avoid whatever products are being taxed?
And Tanner, that makes me wonder, input costs for soybean farmers, the things that you use to ultimately make that soy happen, do you rely on a lot of international products, a lot of international inputs, or is that mostly homegrown and homemade here in the States?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I told you we didn't rely on imports for the inputs. A lot of the world's fertilizer is coming not from the United States. China does produce some. A lot of the phosphorus and things like that. So a lot of fertilizer we're bringing in from international markets. Some equipment, you know, there are several very successful equipment manufacturers all around the world, and a lot of farmers in my area especially, you know, they take advantage of some of the quality products outside of the United States. So yeah, it goes beyond just the actual soybean export market, right?
We're talking about possible tariffs under the Trump administration and what it could mean for us here in Wisconsin. We've got Tanner Johnson, farmer in Northwest Wisconsin, board member of the American Soybean Association, and Tom Kemp, economist professor at UW-Eau Claire. Tanner, I know soy is part of your operation there, but you've got some other crops. Are there situations where China's not taking as much of our soy as they used to. You just move to different crops that might have different potential customers.
Yeah, if there is less demand for soybeans, or United States-grown soybeans anyways, then yeah, we would likely pivot to a more profitable crop to keep our businesses open. However, as you know, we would be flooding another commodity or multiple commodities, which would drive down prices. So tariffs don't have to be a bad thing. And again, I'm going to stress, I'm not trying to be an alarmist, but it's certainly a concern, and I think it's every farmer is going to be watching with very, very close attention to the tariff situation.
Now, Tom, I want to get into one of the main cases for tariffs on imports, and this is something that President Trump has said all along, is that okay, there might be a little pain in the short run, but if we up the prices of some of the products we're importing, whether it's steel or manufactured goods or those fertilizers that Tanner was talking about, we're going to promote that kind of industry here in the United States. We're going to promote economic production here. We're going to promote jobs. What is the track record? Is that something that works in the modern economy?
Production doesn't change overnight. Even shifting from one crop to another is no small task. And these things are planned, many months in advance. The time frame that would be necessary for a radical realignment of domestic production would be decades, certainly not months. So that would be a long time in happening, and maybe never. But I would back up from all of that and say for a second that we could do everything ourselves. We're a large nation. Heck, even Wisconsin could do almost everything itself. It has rich natural resources, a diverse and well-educated population. But do we want to? It would be very challenging to grow mangoes here in Wisconsin, and I like mangoes. I enjoy the fact that we can get mangoes, and I imagine there's a lot of folks in China who really enjoy good Wisconsin ginseng and good Wisconsin soybeans. And when we talk about cutting ourselves off from the world, this is what we're doing. We're essentially saying that we don't want to trade goods and services with that other country, and the market suggests that we like those goods and services, and folks abroad like our goods and services, and we end up making each other all better off as a result of that trade. So I find that argument somewhat unconvincing.
I'll leave it there. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
No, thank you.
And Tanner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Tanner Johnson is a farmer from Northwest Wisconsin and a board member of the American Soybean Association, and Thomas Kemp is chair and professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire. We've been talking about the possible impact of tariffs and trade disputes on Wisconsin.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new podcast from Eau Claire wants to debunk the stereotype that queer people only thrive in big cities.
We're people too. We're in your community. We're here. We're hanging out. And we like to have fun, I guess.
The creators of the Small Town Big Gay podcast, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two Wisconsin natives recently launched a podcast that celebrates being gay in a smaller community. Here's how episodes begin.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Small Town Big Gays. We are the aforementioned gays who are too big for how small of a town this is. I'm Chance.
And I'm Travis.
That is Chance Smith and Travis Gorell, hosts of Small Town Big Gays, who join us now. Chance and Travis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Excited to be here. Thank you for having us.
Chance, let's start with you. The podcast really aims to give a look at queer life from a smaller community perspective. What do you hope people will learn about this perspective compared to a big city?
We get a lot of perspective from New York City or bigger, East Coast cities. And then we get a lot of perspective from places like LA or Seattle. But there are queer people, there are LGBTQ plus people everywhere in between in the country. And things are just different here in smaller town Wisconsin than they maybe are in Los Angeles, where things have been a little more accepting of LGBT people for a lot longer than they have here. So hopefully people just kind of get the perspective that, we're people too. We're in your community. We're here. We're hanging out. And we like to have fun, I guess.
It's a journey, Travis. And it's really cool to be able to get some insights on this journey. What does it feel like for you to launch this podcast in a smaller community?
Like, I grew up in the, millennial generation of having technology kind of come a little bit later in my life. So I feel like I have an interesting perspective of what it was like to grow up as a queer person before and after technology really kind of took off. So yeah, it's just kind of fun to share my stories and experiences of what it was like growing up in a smaller area in Wisconsin.
Can you share more about technology and what has changed for you personally?
In my home, we didn't even have the internet till I was a senior in high school. So I had very limited access to kind of resources and understanding. So it was very much just having to figure things out on my own through experience. And then also just like after I came out and then started doing drag here in Wisconsin as well, it was still very limited resources as far as even like YouTube videos and, you know, like to the TikToks and things like that, that people just have access to so much information now, where before you had to really seek it out and seek out relationships and seek out people and places to find that stuff.
Travis, and you're a well-known local drag performer in Chloe Wold. Can you introduce us to Chloe?
So I've been doing drag here in the Chippewa Valley and beyond for the past 16 years. And yeah, it's like when I started, we just had one monthly show at our local queer bar here in town, and which was lovely and great. I always enjoyed just having that one experience, but I knew I always wanted more for that and for our town. So yeah, now we have two regular monthly shows going. We have several large quarterly events happening. We have drag bingo multiple times a month. Yeah, just tons of different experiences and opportunities. So drag has really been a great tool for me to grow my own confidence and experience as a queer person, and have been able to develop a lot of relationships.
It makes me wonder, Chance, Eau Claire being a college town, how much does that affect quality of life for LGBTQ people in the community?
I think college towns do overall tend to be more accepting of people from more diverse backgrounds and walks of life. I think because they have to be, because there's a large gathering of young people, and young people are all on this journey of discovering themselves and finding out who they are really in life. And so I think it makes this town in particular very accepting and very open to new ideas and different people.
We're talking about a new podcast out of Eau Claire, and it's called Small Town Big Gays. Chance Smith talking there, Travis Gurrell. They are the hosts of this podcast. Going back to some of the topics you take on, Travis, in the episodes, both of you talk openly about yourselves, about your coming of age, sex, relationships. I wonder, is it difficult to open up and be honest behind the mic? And how has that openness, you know, changed within you and perhaps your audience? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think in general, I just tend to be an oversharer, which is probably why I'm perfect for podcasting. So, and just like through doing drag, learning to host events and just like talk to people and the different things that I've been involved in. One of the biggest things I learned through doing drag is when I first started out, there were so many performers that I really looked up to, especially here in the Chippewa Valley. And I thought like, oh my gosh, these people are so beautiful. They're so perfect. Like their life must just be like so great. And then like, I realized that they struggled and dealt with the same insecurities and the same things that I was dealing with. So it really like opened my eyes to just understanding that people are all going through experiences just in a different way. And so that just really opened me up to being more open with people. And through that, I think that's why my career in drag and my career in general have just really been able to expand, because I just have this openness and understanding that at the end of the day, we're all dealing with insecurities, we're all dealing with struggles. So just opening up and talking about it has always just kind of helped me heal through a lot of it too. And it's been really awesome to hear others kind of relating or understanding. It's also really funny. So I host bingo events here in the Chippewa Valley, and I always get like this, some groups of some older women, straight women in the community. and they're always wanting me to be spicier. So I think vicariously living through those experiences as well is kind of fun. So
amping up the spice. You know, Chance, I was drawn to the two of you discussing, you know, when you knew as a kid, when you knew you were gay. And I'm wondering how this opening up behind the mic has affected you and the stories that you tell.
Well, one thing I'm realizing, it's making me remember a lot of stuff from my childhood that I had kind of forgotten about. So we're unpacking some trauma on the mic, that's for sure. Hmm. But it's been great. It's very healthy to, you know, go back and kind of think about things, you know, what it was like as a queer kid growing up, especially in a smaller town than I'm currently living in, and kind of those different things that you deal with both internally and externally in a community like that. And I think that is one of the things that the podcast is great for, is letting people know, you know, your experiences in a smaller town as a queer person, is they're valid. It's weird. It's embarrassing. It's cringy. But, you know, ultimately, it's what made us who we are now. And you just gotta embrace it.
Travis, you grew up in a religious household. You call yourself a missionary kid. And in the first episode, coming out to your family and what that was like for you, can you tell us about your experience?
Yeah, so I did grow up fairly religious, but a lot of it was my own choice. It wasn't my parents' decision to put that on me by any means. So I had a really great experience with religion growing up, thankfully. But I mean, it did definitely alter my coming out and all of that in its own way. Thankfully, my family is really lovely and very open and supportive and understanding. So I do tend to be a little bit of a different case sometimes, where I did have a good experience with religion overall, but it definitely did in some ways hold me back from coming out a lot earlier than I did.
Chance, there's this recent episode, it's called Local Icons, and highlighting role models here in Wisconsin. You talk about having someone to look up to in a small town is rare. How has that shaped your life as a gay man in a small town and having role models?
Queer people, especially when you're young, you look for that kind of person, whether, you know, it back in the day it was Cher for a lot of people, or, you know, some pop icon who you see yourself in, or you see what your life, you know, maybe what you kind of want your life to be like, you know, fabulous and living openly and doing whatever you want and, you know, really experiencing life the way you want to. And I do think a lot of younger queer people, especially in small towns, don't have that. I mean, I didn't really have a gay role model when I was a child. I didn't really have a gay role model of any sort. And I think that is really important to find at some point in your life. Like, I kind of found it later in my life, people to look up to as far as examples of people who they live their life, they're living it openly, they're living proud, and they're just unafraid and unashamed of who they are as a queer person. And I found that later in life. I hope other people find that sooner in life, but I think it's really important for people to find that, and then they themselves can start making steps to living their life authentically, mm-hmm. and then they can be that person for another, you know, another generation of queer youth.
Who fits into that definition for you? Who do you look up to, if I may ask?
One of the big ones would be my husband, Tom. He has been incredibly important to my growth as like a queer person. Honestly, Travis, I said this on the Local Icons episode of the podcast, but Travis is one of my role models as like a very authentic, out loud queer person. Again, does so much for our community, like such a beacon of what we should all aspire to be, even if you are in a small town. And I can't see Travis right now, but I do hope he's tearing up.
Travis, go ahead.
Do you want me to make like a crying sound bit for you right now? Is that what you're...
Right, exactly, exactly.
yeah, for me, it was like, I guess I didn't have like necessarily queer icons growing up, but I was a very queer centric child. And the fact of like, I loved watching figure skating. I loved watching powerful women in movies. And then what really inspired me growing up was my grandmother. And she was like the most important person in my life. And she was just like, emulated beauty and grace, and not only like physical beauty, but just like as a beautiful person who was just very open, always made me feel comfortable, was always my safe space. I unfortunately never was able to actually like come out and share my experience of queer life with her or doing drag. She passed just before all that had happened, which was like kind of the catalyst that really pushed me into living my true authentic life, because I was just like, well, life is short. I need to like make this happen while I can. So for me, it was always just like being inspired by powerful women around me in a male dominated world. Yeah. And then as I like came out as queer, I started meeting other people in the community who just lived authentically as themselves. And I took from their example, and just like I always do, I want to push everything to the max that I can, and have just wanted to be that example for other people too.
Thank you for that. I'm the one now tearing up. Travis, do you feel like this could go on for some time?
Well, as long as people keep listening and are interested, we will talk. I feel like every time we get ready to film, I'm like, I don't know what we're going to talk about. I feel like I've told them everything about my life. And then we start talking about something, I'm like, oh my gosh, I still have so many more tragic stories to share about my life. So
I'm sorry. And that's what I wonder too. Like, how much do you plan in advance of each episode what you will talk about?
You know, we have like a shared note, which is really honestly shocking that I can get into it and figure out how to work that. But we do,
I'm very proud of you.
we do, have like some sort of general, outline ready to go, but honestly, like this week, I just sat on the couch and pretended that I had something ready to go and did not, but it happened to be a really great episode. So I think there's just, I've had so much lived experience in a moderately short life. Well, in gay years, I'm quite old, but I just feel like, yeah, there's just so much to talk about.
You can definitely feel the trust and the friendship and the bond between the two of you. And I think that's what also comes through, Chance, in the podcast.
Well, then I'm glad that the facade is working, because I can't stand him.
Oh, well.
No, I think we both look forward to doing it every week. And honestly, you know, whether people listen or not, I think it's going to keep going for a while, just because we enjoy doing it.
Well, Chance and Travis, all the best to you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That is Chance Smith and Travis Gorrell. They are the hosts of a new podcast. It's called Small Town Big Gays. You're listening to its theme song, created by TYB, a gay hip-hop artist from Eau Claire.
Coming up in the next week, the state's transportation secretary joins the show for a look at an expansion of electric vehicle charging stations around Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have an electric vehicle? How easy is it for you to keep it charged? And are there parts of the state that you currently avoid because of a lack of charging options? Or is that not a problem at all?
And if you're curious about EVs but haven't taken the plunge yet, is the availability of charging stations a factor? Would an expansion of those stations bring you on board?
Tell us about it. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch with us at 888-642-0232. Again, that number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.